You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have a very extraordinary guest with us tonight. 9 times best-selling author, Vietnam vet, aeronautic engineer that worked at NASA, Mr. Homer Hickam Jr. Hello, how are you?
Hey, Nikki, I'm fine. How are you?
Did I get everything right? I know I stumbled on the engineering part, but you know, it's just not enough to say NASA engineer, because you are a super intelligent guy just doing the things that you've done.
Well, thank you. Yes, you got it all right. It's all good.
So let's start from the very beginning, because I really, you know, one of the reasons I love doing this show is, you know, we're going to talk about the books that you've been writing and your latest book, but you know, your life is a fascinating story. So what made you U.S. Armed Forces? What was it, a love of it from the beginning? Were you raised in a family that was like an Army family? What kind of drew you to that?
Well, I was raised in a little town, a little coal mining town in West Virginia, Colwood, West Virginia. And my dad was actually the superintendent of the coal mine there. And wow. So that was my upbringing in this little town. And but when I was 14 years old, Nikki, in 1957, the Russians, who were our big Cold War enemy, launched Sputnik, which was the first satellite in space.
I remember.
And it scared everybody to death in the United States, but it actually thrilled a lot of us teenagers at the time who'd read a lot of science fiction and never imagined that they would grow up during the time that the space age would start. And I was one of those kids. And so I started building rockets. And because I wanted to get in the space business, and my dad was kind of appalled at that idea. And
did you build the ones that you lit and that flew in the air, or just like model rockets?
Yeah, well, you know, these were long before you could go out and buy a kit. So we ultimately built really big, bad rockets. They were going awesome. 4 or 5 miles in the sky. They went supersonic within a half second. They were very,
wow.
very advanced rockets. And, of course, my mom's advice to me was always, don't blow yourself up. You know? And but otherwise, she was behind us, and the little town was behind us, and so therein lies the story that a lot of your folks listening, I suspect, have seen the movie October Sky, where Jake Gyllenhaal played me as that boy, that teenage boy who built rockets in that little mining town and then went off and won the National Science Fair. So there I was at the end of my high school days. And so you were asking, how did I end up in the military? Well, my mom applied for me to go to Virginia Tech, which is across the state line and from West Virginia, but it was the closest engineering school to Colwood. And it turned out it was a military college at the time. And so I became part of the cadet corps. And
was that, did you do ROTC? Is that how you did it? Or was that?
Yeah, before? Well, it's Virginia Tech at that time was sort of like West Point. And we wore uniforms, you know, all the time, and marched everywhere we went, and you know, did the usual military academy type of thing. At the end of that, Vietnam was really starting to heat up, and I graduated in engineering school, so I obviously had some intelligence.
Right.
And I looked out at Vietnam, and I'm thinking, you know, I need to be in the Air Force. So I took Air Force ROTC,
wow.
but I had bad eyes. So it turned out that I nonetheless ended up in the Army and in the 4th Infantry Division over in Vietnam. So that's how that occurred.
You know, what's interesting about that is, you know, you wrote a recent book, we'll get to it, called Don't Blow Yourself Up. And now I know why, because your mom was just like, don't blow yourself up.
Right. Yeah. Don't blow yourself up. And then later, didn't I tell you not to blow yourself up? So, my poor mom had to watch all of this. And when I was in college at Virginia Tech, we played Virginia Military Institute. We were VPI, they were VMI. And they had this little candy football. And then they would yell, their cadet corps would yell at our cadet corps, "Where's your cannon? Where's your cannon?" And so three other guys and I got together, and we ended up building the biggest game cannon ever known. We did this against wow. the administration at the college, wanted nothing to do with this. But we did it anyway.
For good reason.
And so again, when my mom heard what we were doing, it's like, "Didn't I tell you not to blow yourself up? What is wrong with you?" But we did build this cannon. It's called the Skipper. It's an icon at Virginia Tech now. But we fired it. We dragged it out. The VMI Cadet Corps was chanting, "Where's your cannon? Where's your cannon?" We fired this huge cannon. It went off. It cracked the glass in the press box on the other side of the field. And our Cadet Corps went, "Wow. Here's our cannon. Here's our cannon." And so all of a sudden, the Virginia Tech administration loved us and an icon. But my mom had plenty of opportunity during my life to ask me or to tell me, don't blow myself up. So.
That's amazing. You know what? We should have been friends way back when, but because I always loved explosives when I was a kid, so we definitely would have been good chums. So as the Vietnam War is kind of starting to, brood, what made you decide, okay, were you drafted? Did you enlist? Were you like, "I want to do this and go fight for my country"? Were you kind of reserved about it? How did that kind of send you off in this next journey?
Well, I think that most young people growing up in West Virginia and the coal fields at that time were very patriotic. We very much supported our country. Actually, West Virginia had the highest percentage of young men who went to Vietnam than any other state.
Wow.
So that gives you kind of an indication. And so actually, I ended up volunteering for Vietnam. I was stationed first as a lieutenant out at Dugway Proving Ground in Utah, which I still can't talk about what we did there. Personally, I went over to Brigham Young University and dated the Mormon girls. That's what I did.
Smart man. But
there you go. And so, but I looked out and I saw, I'd gone to Virginia Tech, this military college. I'd had a lot of training in explosives. And so I had a lot of training where they were sending a lot of young lieutenants over there who were maybe just out of OCS, and I just thought it was wrong for them to be going and me not going. So I volunteered to go, which astonished the Army so much when I got over there. They didn't really know what to do with me. And I ended up in the 4th Infantry Division. Then they figured out what to do with me. So it was an interesting year, needless to say. I was over there in 67, 68.
Wow. I must say what you're seeing. How did you kind of remain positive? You seem like such a positive soul. You know, a lot of people come back from war, just any war, and it's hard to kind of like bounce back and kind of get back into society. What kind of got you through those years?
Well, one of the things, when you're in a situation like that, Nikki, what you look, if you can, you look around and you realize, you wonder why am I here and what am I doing? And was the government really smart to do what it's doing? So one of the things it did, as I said, very patriotic young man, but it did kind of remove some of the shades from my eyes, if you will, and realize that sometimes our government doesn't know what it's doing. And
most of the time.
Maybe most of the time. I don't know. But anyway, so that was a great revelation. To keep my men safe and taking care of them. So that was my focus over there. When I came back, I remember on the flight back, one of the things I started thinking about, what was I going to do with the rest of my life? I was still in the Army, so I had a couple of years to go, but I started thinking about maybe I could write about this experience in Vietnam or something. So I kind of missed it. I had written for the college newspaper at Virginia Tech. So I realized that I did have some talent to write, although my degree was in engineering. So I just looked to see maybe I could combine those in some way. I have to say that the 10 years after I came back from Vietnam, I was still struggling in a lot of ways. I didn't have the PTSD, which is kind of traditional,
right?
I think. But I don't know why. I mean, I was a little bit older than most of the guys that were over there, but I did my way. And that boy back in Colwood who built those rockets, he knew what he wanted to do. And right. The boy who built that cannon, he knew what he wanted to do. On the other side of Vietnam, I had no clue really what I wanted to do, what I was capable of doing. So it took me.
Well, war changes you. I mean, I wouldn't expect you to know how to, you know, kind of readapt back into society because it's.
I was missing something. I was missing some great passion in my life. I'd had that passion, you know, again, with the rockets. And then I had that passion with building the cannon and going to engineer school and all that. After Vietnam, I had no passion very much for anything. What saved me really was scuba diving. And so I learned to scuba dive down in Puerto Rico, sort of, kind of. I was taught everything the wrong way to do it. But I ended up working for the Army as a civilian up in Huntsville, Alabama. And the mentor of the world, his name was Cliff McClure. And Huntsville is a NASA town, a space town, military town, a high-tech town. And Cliff had been, before there were, our first astronauts were called Mercury astronauts. They flew on the in the Mercury capsule, the Mercury 7. Well, even before that, there was a set of test pilots who flew in these balloons that went up to 100,000 feet. And, and they were testing these capsules. And it was called the Man High program. And Cliff was one of those guys. And so he had left the Air Force and opened up this little tiny little scuba shop in Huntsville.
He obviously knew how to deal with air pressure because you deal with it when you're that high up and you deal with it when you're in the water.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Boyle's law, pressure and volume vary inversely. You need to know that. All divers need to know that. It's like you never, never, never want to hold your breath.
Right.
Why don't you want to hold your breath? Because you're breathing air at pressure underwater. And when you come up, it expands, right? So this is not a good thing. And so you're right. So Cliff taught me very, very technically, a lot of the technical stuff behind diving, not just the technique of diving. But I just really caught this passion for it. And suddenly my life kind of came a lot more in focus because I was working as an engineer for the Army, and that was good. I had that little, you know, the money, the paycheck was coming in, and I was working on missiles. And then I had this scuba, and I became a scuba instructor for Cliff. And then I started writing about it because this was in the early 70s, and it was scuba diving was all kind of brand new to everybody. Right. And so all of a sudden I was carving out these niches, and my whole life came into focus. And
I love that you took something, you know, you took an experience where, you know, you're seeing people dying, you're seeing people fighting, and then you went under the ocean and, you know, you went in the ocean and underwater and wanted to just observe a completely different world. And you took it in such a positive way. It must have been super therapeutic. I'm a water man. Like I'm in the ocean water at least 3 times a week. I love to bodyboard. I love scuba diving. I love snorkeling. I love it all. So tell me how that phase affected you, because it had to affect you, because being in water affects me, and it affects me when I'm not in water too. So how did that experience kind of affect your life in a positive way?
Well, I'm glad that diving off California is positive to you. I remember that 55 degree water out there. So I did teach for a short time up in Santa Barbara. So I wore that quarter inch wetsuit. But it's beautiful out in the kelp beds and all that. What happened was that, of course, I fell in love with the tropics. I ended up actually going down to Honduras a lot and discovered this island called Guanaja, Isla de Guanaja, and off the north coast of the Atlantic or Caribbean coast of Honduras. So I kind of adopted that. I went there as often as I could, explored the island, met the people down there, and that was really good for me. And, you know, but what really transformed the diving into something else was that I started writing about diving on shipwrecks, and I wrote for Skin Diver and Sport Diver and Underwater USA and a number of these magazines that were available back in the 70s and 80s. And we heard that, I heard that there was a wreck discovered off North Carolina, appeared to German, and but nobody knew anything about it, why it was there or anything. So I was asked by Sport Diver to go up there and dive on it and see if I could make any sense of what it was. And I was enough of a World War II buff as soon as I went. It was 110 feet of water out in the Gulf Stream, about 30 miles off Cape Hatteras. And as soon as I saw it, I knew exactly what it was. It was a Type 7 German U-boat of the type that we had heard that rumors that they came over here during World War II. And when I dived on it, I went up in the conning tower. Hardly anybody had been on it by then, and looked. The hatch was open, and I looked down. Looked like a bowl that I wanted. You know, like all wreck divers, we want to get something off the wreck, right?
Right.
So I reached down for this bowl and picked it up, and it was a human skull.
Wow!
So I knew at that moment something had really happened here that I wanted to uncover. What I ultimately ended up uncovering over about a 15-year period after that was not only the story of this U-boat, which was the U-352, but it was the second U-boat that was sunk by American forces during World War II, was that there was this huge battle off the East Coast during World War II that was mostly kept secret, where almost 500 of our ships were sunk and 9 U-boats.
Wow.
It was a huge battle. And so I was really onto something at that point, Nikki, that nobody else had really written about this or uncovered it. And 1976, the Freedom of Information Act was passed. So I was able to hit the National Archives before anybody and get this story. And that became my first book, a book called Torpedo Junction, which is still in print. It came out in 1989 and tells the story of a horrific battle.
And you wanted to document them and tell these stories because, you know, I think that's like the greatest and most, you know, important human characteristic that we can pass on is storytelling. So the fact that you used writing as a way to kind of, you know, capture these, you know, epic adventures you've been on, it's so tremendous. So you wrote this book. How long did it, the first book that you wrote, how long did it take you to write?
Well, that first book took almost 15 years of research.
Wow.
and work. I mean, when I sat down to write it, probably took me about 3 years. And a lot of it was, there were just so much, I just had so much information at that time. But what I figured out over the course of writing a lot of, for a lot of these magazines and so on, what people are really interested in ultimately is other people. And so when I wrote Torpedo Junction, it's not just all this statistics and data and technical stuff. It's about the people, the men from both sides that were out there fighting this horrific battle and living with what they were having to go through and all the fear and the dying and so on. So I really thought that that was the book that I was born to write. And then lo and behold, about 10 years later, it turned out to be
Rocket
Boys was the book that I was meant to write. It was the one that I would become semi-sort of famous for. But I really had to be convinced ultimately to write that. I didn't see the value of it. It took other people from the outside looking in saying, you know, growing up in this coal town by itself is interesting.
Right.
We don't have too many writers come out of the coal fields of southern West Virginia. But then you built rockets. Can you not see the? And finally, I did enough that I wrote it, and it was a big success. And they made that movie, October Sky.
Let's talk about that.
Hall played me.
So. Yeah, that had to have been a little bit of a trip to see a Hollywood reenactment of your life. Did they get things right? Did you see that they were changing things, or did they really stay on point with what you put in your book and the stories you were telling?
Yeah, I mean, well, Nikki, I mean, the first thing you kind of have to accept when you're an author and they're going to make a movie about your book is that movies are a different art form.
Right.
And unless you get that, you're going to be kind of glum about the whole process, right? They
right.
just can't. I mean, I'm like any other author. I would love it if they would just film page by page by page by page. But I get that. You only have about an hour and a half to tell a story that takes place over 3 years. That took, you know, I've got 500 pages in the book or whatever. and a lot of detail about other characters. And so it's just too many characters, too many events, and so on. So it was an interesting process, really. I was able to take kind of a step back from it. And Lewis Kulick, a wonderful screenplay writer, wrote the screenplay for it. And Lewis and I talked on the phone an awful lot. He was from Brooklyn. At first he wasn't sure, but he could write about West Virginians. And it's like, after I talked to him, it's like, well, you grew up in a neighborhood, and that neighborhood was just like my little town of Colwood. You couldn't get away with anything, right? Everybody reported back to your parents. And so we had a very good relationship, and ultimately Lewis wrote a wonderful screenplay. And I ended up on set most days. They asked me to be a consultant. And it's unusual for the author, and especially the...
Well, you're a resource. You're like the source material, you know?
Yeah. So Joe's the director's risk letting me be on set all that time. I mean, for one thing, I could have ended up upsetting the other actors just by being there, and maybe they were thinking I was critiquing their performance. But Chris Cooper played my dad, and Laura Dern played my teacher, and Natalie Kanerday played my mom, and of course, Jake Gyllenhaal and the other boys. They were all consummate professionals, and they did a wonderful job.
Did Jake Gyllenhaal, you know, use you as a reference, or did he want to just be independent and try to, you know, kind of interpret your life on his own?
Well, it was interesting about Jake. Jake was only 16 when he made that movie, and he was still in high school. And they actually had a tutor on set. He was taking, I think, calculus and French.
Wow,
which is an interesting combination in the first place, but. But Jake had to have his mom there also. And so while the other boys who were a little older, it was mostly filmed around Oak Ridge, Tennessee. They were all down at the Oak Ridge Walmart hanging out with the Tennessee girls. Poor Jake had to go back to the hotel room with his mom. But Jake and I developed a friendship on set. I talked to him a lot about what we were doing back when I was a boy, and tried to give him, you know, some of the motivation that I might have had back then. And but you could just, I think everybody sensed that Jake was really going to break out and become the wonderful actor that he is today and the star that he is today. So we saw that in him right off the bat, and it was just a wonderful experience to see a movie being made. And I realize how hard it is.
Life, you know, first you're on set and seeing them filming it, and then seeing the final cut, and you know, now the movie's released. How do those two experiences kind of change what you were experiencing during it, and also how it changed how you reflected on what had happened in your life?
Yeah, I like to think while they were making it, I mean, I personally thought to myself, oh, well, you know, I'm a professional here, and I've done a lot of things in my life already, fighting in Vietnam, and I trained the first Japanese astronauts and lived over there, and I went over to Russia and negotiated on, man, that's like another thing in my life, you know. Really, so I just took this step back, and I was watching the technical process and all of that that kind of thing. But we saw some of the rushes, but you never know how this movie is going to be here. When I saw the edited piece, I was quivering. I was shaking. It suddenly became so impossible that this was happening. And Jake Gyllenhaal was up there playing me, and people were laughing in the audience. They were crying. All this emotion, and it just seemed to cascade down on top of me at that point. So, yeah, it was a very emotional experience, as it turned out.
So let me ask you, now you've written the sequel, you know, Don't Blow Yourself Up. How did you kind of approach writing a sequel to this story and kind of erase, like, all the success that came with that to kind of start, you know, because you kind of have to do that. You can't have any kind of influences, you know, inflating the ego, as they say, because you're building a structure, you're building, you know, a vision, and you kind of have to put all those things, you know, to the wayside. How did you kind of focus on what you wanted to say for this next story?
Yeah, I mean, you know, they say if you're going to write a memoir, you're either really full of yourself or you've got a good story to tell, right?
Yeah, you have a good story to tell, for sure.
Well, hopefully, yeah. And so what I discovered writing Rocket Boys was that I started down the wrong path when I started writing it. I thought, well, again, I had this experience. I was a NASA engineer, well known. And I thought, well, I'll write about a little bit about being a NASA engineer, and then I'll flash back to when I was in the coal field. I'll go back and forth. And I wrote, I was 200 pages into this thing, and I realized, this, I'm not interested. I don't care. You know, so this is not working. And I had a friend from the coal fields days, and she was a professor at Ohio University. And she said, you know what, you need to write it as Sonny would tell it, because that's what I was called back then. She said, I always loved that boy. And it's like, okay, I need to find Sonny and let him tell this story. And so I like to say I got $1 million worth of psychotherapy I didn't even know I needed when I wrote Rocket Boys, because I stripped everything away. I went back and became that 14-year-old, 14 through 17.
So you have to. You have to become that person.
You have to. And so I let him tell the story. And that wasn't always easy, because I had, you know, as we get older, we start lying to ourselves a little bit about what has happened before, and especially in my relationship with my dad. I, you know, over these years, I just kind of built scar tissue over all of that. And I had to go tear that away and let that boy be disappointed again that his father apparently didn't love him as much as that boy thought that he should.
Right.
And, but in the process of doing that, I discovered I could then see how that boy felt. And now go back to myself as an adult, and my dad had passed away by then, but I could realize how good of a dad that he really was, and what, and the pressure that was on him that I could not see when I was a teenager. So I think that's why Rocket Boys works. You really get a feel that this is that boy living through this experience. Yes, there's the rockets and all that triumph and all that inspiration, but underlying this is it's a father-son story. So now that book came out in 1998, so now it's 2021, and I want to go ahead and tell the rest of the story, but you're right. I had to go back and be that boy in college and see him mature. And then I really was not looking forward to this, Nikki. I went back and relived that year in Vietnam. I really was not looking forward to that. So I can now allow myself to let the pace quicken till I finally got to work for NASA, this boyhood dream, and make all these dreams come true. And I hope, and I've heard that when people read Don't Blow Yourself Up, they feel like that they're at my shoulder all the time, and they're experiencing the same thing that I went through. But I'm always very careful, and it's true. I'm not the hero of this piece. It's the men and women around me, ultimately, that have the wisdom that get me through these scrapes. And you have to recognize that and put in there when you really mess up. And I did mess up over the years in one way or the other, and I put that in there. And then how did I get through that? How did I get out of it ultimately to have a good life?
I love that. I think that is kind of for all of, you know, in order, we are the vessel, but it's, you know, the elements around it are the people and the environment that you're around. Now you talked about, you know, kind of the relationship you had with your father, which was somewhat traumatic. Did you find any resolution or perspective that, you know, changed the way you looked at those years when you were going through it? Or did you find that, you know, later in life, you were able to look backwards in a way that was more appreciative because of everything that you weren't able to see in the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you read Rocket Boys, you realize that the father is really the hero in this story, and that he is sacrificing in ways that this boy doesn't know. It doesn't know. You know it, but the boy doesn't know it. And the same thing is really true. And, you know, in terms of support, my mom always gave me huge support. And she was, you know, don't blow yourself up, but if you have to, go ahead, you know. I mean, you, Sonny, you do what you have to do here. And I believe in you, and I trust that that you're going to do okay. And so, but over the year, I never really had the relationship with my father that I wanted to have. Whatever it was, I just didn't have it.
Well, it was also the timing. I mean, it was post-World War II, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a different breed of a person. The generation, the whole generation was affected like that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I've heard from a lot of men and women of my age or a little bit younger, you know, the so-called boomers, who had distant fathers. Well, most of us did. Why did we have distant fathers? Because they were at work all the time. And they had come up through the Depression. They'd gone, you know, fought during World War II. They had come home, and their idea of a family at that point was just working hard enough to put a roof over their head, have food on the table, work so hard they come home exhausted at the end of the day. And also, of course, most of the women didn't work. They worked during World War II, but after that they didn't, for the most part. All that went away for a long time. And so here the women are at home, and their job is to take care of the kids and to run the house and so on. And so, you know, that was the tendency of that generation of fathers. They weren't big huggers and kissers or anything like that. Was that if they gave you a roof over your head and they gave you food on your table and they gave you books to study, what else do you want from me? You know, that kind of thing. And it took me a long time to really I didn't fight with my dad about it, but I was hurt. You know, I was wounded.
Well, it's kind of like it was the unspoken thinking. Oh, I'm providing. That's my way of showing love. And you just wanted time. You know, you just wanted attention from him or to make him proud, which I'm sure he was. But it's like this unspoken law that, you know, you don't kind of talk about. And it's also the generation. It's like parenting now, from what, you know, my friends tell me that, you know, have kids, it's a very different bag than what your father went through. And it's because of the gender roles and like how it was, you know, post World War II, that generation of just like the man comes home and provides, and the parenting part, that's all, you know, a big question mark, because they're just trying to survive, you know. And I'm sure he was just doing what he could to make sure there was security and some, you know, way for you to be protected. But it's just hard to see that when you're just a kid.
And, you know, he was responsible for like 600 men who went underground every day. He was also responsible for the town itself, which was a town of 2,000 people. And he had a lot of weight on his shoulders. And and that not only drained him physically, but also, I'm sure, mentally as well. And so, but I understood that better after I started working, and, you know, I'd gone through Vietnam and doing all these other things and being responsible for other people. And so I got it after a while, but it was a little bit too late for us at that point in a lot of ways. I mean, we would still, I mean, my dad, he would show his pride in interesting ways. It was more or less telling Elsie, his wife, to tell Sonny, you know, rather than telling me directly, that he was kind of proud that I ultimately did work for NASA, and that ultimately, and what he really liked was that I wrote that book, Torpedo Junction. He died right after that same year, but he bought a number of books to give to his friends there. And that's so
awesome. That generation too, they don't show pride. You know what I mean? Like he probably bragged to his friends about all the things that you were doing, but to you, he didn't want you to see that because that would make you, you know, aspire less or achieve less. So he's doing this, you know, indirect, tough love, you know? Yeah. So,
well, you know, West Virginians, we don't like people who get puffed up,
right?
You know, and so we're always very careful not to be puffed up. If you know what I mean, it's just like, yes, of course. I saved the world the other day, but it was nothing. I mean, like Chuck Yeager grew up 30 miles from where I did. Chuck Yeager, you know, who broke the sound barrier, and they made the movie The Right Stuff mostly about him. Well, you know, Chuck was like, sure I did it. Anybody could have done it. Well, nobody could have done what he did. But that's kind of the ethos there in that state, is that you got to be very careful and not brag on yourself. It's kind of hard to write a memoir, though. I mean, you write a memoir and it's like, wait a minute, did you just brag about yourself in that book? And it's like, no, I didn't. It's like,
well, it's because you recognize you have a story to tell.
I have a story. And you know, that's another thing about West Virginians, is that we tend to be storytellers. So I grew up, now my dad wasn't particularly good. He could tell a good story, and occasionally he would, around the kitchen table. But I was, you know, up and down the streets in Colwood, it's like, there were a lot of storytellers that just loved to tell stories, and that you have either popular fiction or nonfiction or memoirs, is how do you tell a story? How do you make the reader want to turn the page to see what's going to happen to this character? And so you've got to understand how a story evolves and what ultimate punchline you're headed to, and don't give it away too soon, which is what a lot of novice writers that I've helped over the years, they would just want to get right to the punchline. And it's like, no, you've got to hold back.
Restraint. I find restraint is
hard. It's hard, though. It's hard. Yeah.
With any creative endeavor. Now, when you were writing this, did you kind of have like a methodical way to kind of sit down and write? Or did you just sit and type when you were inspired? How did that work?
Oh, no. I mean, writing is ultimately work. And you have to approach it in a workman, in my opinion. You have to approach it in a workmanlike effort. And that is, so when I, usually when you go out to a publisher and say, here's my book, here's what I want to write. And they go, okay, write it. And I'm at that point now where I can kind of do that rather than submit a manuscript and worry. And I had to do that at first and worry about it. So I can kind of say, okay, this is what I want to write. And then, of course, that's easy to say. And then, oh, well, now how am I going to do this? And but I've done enough books now. Don't blow yourself up. I don't say it was easy. Again, I got a lot of psychotherapy. I didn't know I needed in the process of writing it. But I do know. Now I've had enough experience that I know how to structure a book. And so I just crashed into it and just started writing. Now I'm also a professional writer enough to know that that a lot of what I write, I don't have to worry about it particularly being good. If I don't feel very good that day and I realize I'm not writing very good, I still am going to go ahead and do it because I can go back and fix it.
Right.
And a lot of novice writers get really, really concerned because, I don't think this is very good. Well, it almost doesn't matter. You need to go ahead and get it done, get it down, and then you go back. And if there's any magic that comes out in my work, it's generally in the rewrite. And
how many rewrites do you usually do when you do a book?
I read that book at least 10 times, probably more. And so you got to be very careful about that. After a while, you've read it so many times, you don't see the errors in it because you just fix them in your head.
Right. But
you do have to be you have to be willing as a writer that to take the time to keep reading your work over and over and over again and make sure that it's saying what you want to say. And also, I have to say that sometimes when I'm writing and I think to myself, oh, this is really, really good. Oh, my God, Homer, you're into it today, buddy. In the back of my head, there's a little voice that says, but you do realize that you're going to throw this away, don't you? Because it's too good. You know, it's like, oh, all these flowery descriptions and so on. It's like, no, the modern reader doesn't really go into that that much. It's called hoop-de-doodle. John Steinbeck called it hoop-de-doodle. And he wrote a book called Sweet Thursday. Every other chapter, he marked it hoop-de-doodle because he says, you know, all writers like to write hoop-de-doodle, but hardly any readers like to. So you can skip every other chapter in this book. But if you want hoop-de-doodle, here it is. And I've always admired that about Steinbeck taking the risk in that book.
Well, that leads me to my next question. First of all, Grapes of Wrath is one of my favorite books ever written.
Mine too.
Who are some of your biggest influences? You said Steinbeck, but as authors you love to read, I'm sure Hemingway was probably one of them. Steinbeck.
Yeah, I can read Kerouac and I can read Hemingway without worrying too much about copying their style. And Steinbeck, I have trouble with. If I read Steinbeck right before I start writing something, I'm going to end up writing bad Steinbeck. because our style is somewhat similar. I'm a Southern writer, and Steinbeck wasn't, but there's a kind of a rhythm to the writing, and you want your reader to subconsciously get into that same rhythm. And if you miss something, ooh, it jars them. That's not necessarily good, but you want to keep this rhythm going until you reach your punchline. That's when you want to jar them with, you want to surprise them all the time. I would have, you know, I've read I love like the old maritime adventures, Patrick O'Brien, and he's, you know, the Aubrey Maturin books about the old Napoleonic era sea captain. I can read those again, and I don't have to worry about copying his style. There's no way in the world, but I just enjoy the way he surprises me as I go along, and I want to turn the page. So to me, any author of it can make me want to keep turning the page and see what's going to happen. The only part of that that's not good is that often I'll stop short and go, wait a minute, I've read a dozen pages here and totally absorbed in the story. What did this writer do that so I'm technical enough that I want to go back and figure out what did he just, he or she do,
right,
that made me want to turn the page. So I will stop and take myself, unfortunately, out of the story, which writer, you know, as a writers sometimes do, and just look at the technique of this author and go, my gosh, you know, I don't know if I could do that, but I got to remember what she did here. See if I can do something not like it. You want to copy, but something like that. So I'm an eclectic reader. I read just a lot of things. As kids, of course, we didn't have the television and all of that that kids have today. So we tended to read a lot, and I read the Bobbsey Twins. I read the Hardy Boys series.
I love the Hardy Boys. I grew up with that.
Yeah, aren't they great? And I mean, and really, you to tell a story to I mean, my goodness, you can learn how to tell. And I think that the authors that struggle to tell stories maybe should go back and study those kind of Nancy Drew, you know, Hardy Boys, Bobbsey Twins. They tell stories in a very clean, simple way that if you understand how the stories are being told, then you can kind of maybe evolve from that. But you kind of have a place, I think, to evolve from. And so in order to be a good writer, you have to be a good reader.
I love that. Oh, it gave me chills. I'm a huge fan of Mark Twain, huge fan of F. Scott. Oh.
Well, yeah, I kind of forgot to mention Mark Twain.
Oh, no,
yeah.
No. You know,
I mean, seriously, I don't think,
you know, in a lot of ways, you know.
Yeah, I don't think any American writer can really write well unless they are familiar with Mark Twain.
He's the best. He's the best.
He really is. He's a gold standard. Yeah.
So that do you ever find that there's like a pressure that you put on yourself when you're writing, when you read all these, you know, authors that tell great stories? Do you find that when you're kind of like focusing on your story, when you're writing, you ignore that kind of pressure, or do you kind of rise to the occasion because of that pressure when you're writing?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was a freelance writer for many, many years while I was working for the Army and then a little bit while I was working for NASA. And so as a freelance writer, you learn to be rejected, which is good for a writer, because, you know, you're trying to guess what the editor of this magazine wants, and maybe you're just not the writer for them. However, you just get a rejection slip in the mail, which I read all the time still, that a lot of writers are just absolute new writers, mostly, that are absolutely crushed when you get a rejection, like just a slip, a note or something like that. Well, you know, but you shouldn't be, because you've created something, and now you go, okay, so it didn't work for them, but what can I do to make it work for somebody else? Or sometimes I'll set this aside, but I learned something in this process. And so you always learn something with your writing, whether it's rejected or not. But writers do have to have a real thick skin. I'm the world's worst. I do go out and read my Amazon reviews. I do.
Oh, no, you shouldn't.
I know. I hate myself for it. But I'm curious.
Curiosity.
I'm curious, yeah. You know?
Yeah. the thing is, you can't, you know, really appease everybody.
No, and I realize that. Yeah.
And a lot of people that, you know, have any criticisms are people most of the time that don't respect the craft because they haven't done it themselves and don't know what it takes. And B, they just, you know, are negative people, you know, more so than anything. So you got to ignore the haters.
I know. But I didn't want to be one of those authors or actors that who pretends like, no, I never read my reviews. We all read our reviews. You're right. I don't let it affect me. I really can't, you know, I have a style, I have a method, I have stories to tell. And if you don't like it, well, I'm sorry. I really am. I'll keep trying until I get it right, which means I never will. So I get to keep trying, right?
Well, you know, the funny thing is like Stephen King, he's also one of my favorite authors. He's not, you know, revered as this literary, you know, pioneer by any means, but yet some of his stories have been some of the coolest movies and some of the best stories and books. And, you know, you kind of, he ignores a lot of the critical, both the acclaim and the criticisms, because he kind of thinks everything is about the story. And as long as I get the story out and I finish it, that's all that matters. And I just love that so much. It's all about the art. It's not about the response or the reaction to it. It's just about him making this thing that we all get to, you know, experience.
That's true. I do remember him, though, however, getting mad at some reviews of a movie that he produced and directed. But Stephen King is just, he's a master, clearly. And the amount of work that he turns out astonishes me. And it's all good quality work. Right. And so it's pretty amazing. And that's a gift. You know, I mean, that's another thing is that you can't be successful. Or you shouldn't be successful, I think, and just say, well, it's because of me. It's all about me, right? But it's because of me. It's not. There's something else going on in this universe, and there's, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Well, I mean, you know, most people would be happy with one bestseller. You've managed to have several and many. Now, how does that affect your creative process when you're writing? Like, I'm sure you're cultivating another book that has yet to be finished. How does that affect?
Yeah, I don't think it affects me. It's just that I have these stories to tell. I enjoy it. It's the process of writing to me is just so enjoyable. I love
therapeutic. It's therapeutic. Yeah.
Well, whatever it is, Nikki, it's something that I love to do. And so I'd rather do that than just about anything. And so when I'm sitting down in front of the keyboard, which is about every day, I'm writing something every day, that time just flies by. It's right. Like, you know, all of a sudden 3 hours, 4 hours are just gone. And everything else, you know, it's okay. It's fine. And I have a good time, you know, diving, everything else. Oh, that's wonderful. I still do that.
I have a scuba diving question for you.
Okay. All right.
I remember snorkeling in the Great Barrier Reef. This was maybe 1990, and seeing, you know, the reef. Well, you were diving before then. Now, have you recently gone diving and seen how many of the reefs kind of around the world are dead or dying? Like, how have you seen that evolution of, you know, let's call it like we should. There are more colors underneath the water when I first saw the Great Barrier Reef than I've ever seen above water. And now it's all, you know, just brown. I recently went to a trip to Kauai and went diving, and I was astonished at how that island had changed in about maybe 10 years for me, from my last trip there. And I'm sure you have seen super healthy reefs and have seen how they've deteriorated. How has that affected you as far as diving or in life?
Well, I mean, short answer is over it. And for those of us who have dived a lot over the years and seen it just as you did in the Great Barrier Reef, and we go back and we realize, hey, the oceans are really in trouble here. And so there are myriad reasons for it that are causing it, but it is a fact. And it's one of the things that that we really need to pay attention to, in my opinion. That is probably the near term disaster, even more than climate change, which I think is a little bit longer term. It is happening, don't get me wrong, but the oceans right now are in big trouble. And so we have a home down in St. John, the Virgin Islands, and I've really seen the reefs deteriorate there. I mean, just big time, even before the storms, the big hurricanes that we had down there, which destroyed a lot of the reef structure. There's a lot of coral bleaching going on, and all of a sudden, where you had life stewards for the ocean, and divers are the eyes on the underseas that you don't see from the top. You know, everything looks fine on the top. You go underneath, and you realize how badly the reefs are suffering these days. I think the ones that are around the islands, I can pretty well tell you what's going on. A lot of pollution.
Right.
More people on the islands, more sewage going into the islands, and then also
sunblock. It's as simple as sunblock, too. A lot of sunblocks aren't the reef friendly. So,
that's true.
Some sunblocks.
And silt from all the construction. Now, over time, maybe after all the construction is done, then all that silt will settle out. But right now, the reefs are struggling because of that. You're right. Even something simple as sunblock causes that. So focus on around. If you go around the world, unfortunately, in the third world, where a lot of the really wonderful reefs are, you see all this plastic, all this garbage, all this stuff that needs to be.
Well, you know what's crazy? I don't know if you know this. So, a lot of what the United States does is we actually sell our leftover plastics that we don't recycle to third world countries. We literally pay them to take our leftover plastic. So what's really unfortunate, it is ingrained in some of the cultures, but it's also some of the wealthy countries of the world making deals where they're just giving their plastics and it's just not being utilized. So it's just like, it just drives me crazy. I because you've been diving for so long, I knew that you had noticed all of those things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And when you're a new diver now, you look at the ocean and, I hear it all the time. Oh, the reef was so beautiful. While I was thinking, oh, it's not really but yet there's still a lot of beauty there. But you see the patches of dead coral that didn't exist and that kind of thing. I'm not one to say, I have a solution for that, but I don't have a solution for it. It's a very difficult problem. People on these islands and in the third world are trying to live the best they can, and they inadvertently end up, polluting the ocean around them, which ultimately causes even more poverty for whatever reason. And I think one of the things that we definitely could do and should do is there shouldn't be any plastics made, in my opinion, that don't deteriorate naturally.
I agree.
And so we need to get away from that because I think that's just one problem, but that is a big one with all this plastic that's in the world that now is in our oceans. And there's where we need international agreements, in my opinion, and really putting legal restraints on plastic.
Well, it's interesting because
for 1,000 years and doesn't deteriorate.
I talked to somebody, a local in Kauai, and they said, during the pandemic, the reefs were recharged and coming back to life because there were no people in the water and there was no trash and there was no life. As we know, it's kind of bothering this world underneath the water. So I thought that was really interesting. I was like, wow, that's crazy that we are very responsible for all of that.
Well, we are. And of course, as scuba divers and scuba instructors, we have a responsibility too, especially as instructors, to say, don't hang on to the reefs. Don't walk on the coral. Don't do all of this. I mean, I'm one who believes in freedom, but there are some don'ts in the world that are important. And one of those is leave the reef alone. Don't touch the reef. Just hands off.
Yep.
And don't be going down there killing a whole lot of fish that you don't need to kill. And by the way, all these dragnets that are bringing all of these fish in, that is not a renewable resource as we used to think. You're tearing up the ocean. So there are things that would be really good for the world where governments could get together, and I wish that they would, and work toward that. But I think, it's a lot like space. we have more and more people going into space, and they're looking at the world and with different eyes. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, the atmosphere is so thin. And then there's just nothing. There's emptiness. There's darkness up there. And that's William Shatner, when he took his little ride. I was so impressed by him, what he had to say. Oh my gosh, it's like life. Here's life and here's death. Life, death, life, death. I get it now. Right. And so I think it's the same way with the ocean. It's like, okay, as darkness of the world never sees. And so it's up to us to kind of report back on that and also do whatever we can to bring that to people in power that actually could do something about it and should. Well,
I love that you have that respect for the ocean, because I share that with you. Let me ask you about your writing. What is like one of the biggest obstacles you have when you're writing, when you're in the thick of it? Maybe it's chapter 10, maybe it's towards the end, maybe it's just starting. What do you find is the biggest obstacle for you as a creator, as an author?
Oh, I don't know, Nikki, that's a hard question, because again, like I said, I've written enough now, but I know that if it's not any good, I'll end up throwing it away anyway. Or if it's too good, I'll end up throwing it away anyway.
See, you can't edit. I mean, you can't censor it. You know, it's like that's the. Yeah. I feel like, you know, when you know, I do that now too. It's as a writer, how powerful you can create is when you're not getting in the way of the creation at all. It's like you are just kind of almost being like, you know, allowing the filter to not exist, because you could be throwing something away that could be unbelievable that you think is terrible. You know what I mean? Just never know.
I hear you. One of the cool things about computers is that you never throw anything away. I have ended up doing it. Matter of fact, with Don't Blow Yourself Up, I had written some short things about in Vietnam or when the movie was made, and that I had written all this stuff and didn't do anything with it. I'd put it aside, but I knew where it was. I went and brought it out. It needed reworking, reshaping, and so on, but that really saved me a bit of time to do that. Obstacles, you know, it's just, I do understand sometimes when you get into a plot problem that you can't get yourself out of.
Right.
But I think, and when I'm writing fiction, I do that deliberately. I want to put myself into a plot problem that I can't imagine how in the world that the hero or heroine is going to get out of this. And so then I've got to think my way through it and or go back and rewrite them out of it before it happens. But hopefully that doesn't happen. But yeah, obstacles in terms of writing, again, one thing that I found about new writers, and again, I've taught some writing courses, is that a lot of times they get stuck on that first book and they just can't get out of that first book, and they just grind and grind and grind on it. And it's usually the second book that's the one that gets published and gets you a name. So you just kind of not working and put it aside and promise yourself, I'll get back to it. And you may never. But you can promise yourself, if that's what it takes, and start anew, because you have learned so much writing that first book that you didn't even realize how much you did learn. And now start fresh with what you know and put that aside. It's so hard for some writers to do that. They just get stuck on it. They never get out of it, you know?
I've got a great, this is my last question, a great question that a lot of people kind of wish they could ask the authors of books they read. You have this new book, Don't Blow Yourself Up. What's the one thing you want your readers to get out of this book for you?
I want them to feel the passion that I felt throughout my long life. I want them to feel like that they're living it with me as I live it, and feel everything that I feel, the thrill of success, but then also the disappointment, but the willingness to work through that disappointment, to do something else. I want them to feel the same things that I felt throughout these 40 years that I write about.
Homer, you are an extraordinary soul. Thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. I would love to have an open door policy with you. Whenever you have a book, please reach out. I'd love to have you on the show again. You are a fascinating soul, an incredible author. You've got an amazing plethora of stories, and I look forward to just engaging in more of your stories and more of your books and seeing more that you can create, because I think the world needs it. So thank you for all that you've done to be a creator and an author and just a wonderful human being. I really mean that.
Well, thank you, Nikki, and I look forward to talking to you again and maybe going diving together somewhere.
Yeah, else. Let's do it. I'm in. I'm all in. You let me know. You all got right, my buddy. Email, okay? Okay. Happy holidays, Homer. And to all thank of you, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays on behalf of myself and Sam. We'll see you guys next week. Be good. Merry Christmas, Homer, okay? Take care. Be good. Peace and love to your family, okay?
And to you.
Listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Korula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.